Good afternoon, Canadian COVID Care Alliance members. My name is Dr. Jessica Rose, and today I'd like to talk to you a little bit about my most recent VAERS update, and I will start with some background. What is VAERS? VAERS is an acronym that stands for Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, and VAERS in particular is the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System for the United States. It was conceived by the FDA and the CDC in 1990, and it is used to report what we know as adverse events, which are any side effects that arise in proximity, temporal proximity, to the injection of a biological product. These can range from mild adverse events, such as injection site pain or a headache, to severe adverse events, which can include death. Pharmacovigilance in VAERS is very important. VAERS is actually a pharmacovigilance tool of the FDA and the CDC, and it's used for the detection of adverse events that aren't recognized in pre-market testing. One must understand that VAERS is imperfect at best. It's very useful. You have to acknowledge that underreporting is a serious problem, and underrecording is a problem as well. If adverse event reports become too plentiful, then backlogs of data can accumulate, and then the safety signals can be lost, for example. To date, hundreds of thousands of adverse events have been reported to VAERS in the context of the COVID products alone. So today I want to cover two categories which contain in themselves two subjects: safety and efficacy. These are the most important things to talk about when designing a new biological product of any kind. So I'm going to cover a little bit about each. In terms of safety, I'm going to show you some adverse event counts and ratios. I'm going to show you what the backlog looks like, and I'm going to talk to you about the underreporting factor, or the IRF, as I'm calling it. I'm also going to talk about causation, which is a very hot debate. And then on the efficacy side, I'm going to talk a little bit about this Delta variant, and then talk about breakthrough infections and epigenetic pressure, and then clue it up with some final thoughts. So we have to discuss what safety and efficacy in biologicals means from an historical point of view. So a typical vaccine development timeline is 5 to 10 years. It can even take longer. This is required in order to assess properly the safety and efficacy of a particular biological in the clinical trials. You also need FDA approval, you need regulatory approval, and you need to manufacture sufficient quantities in order to distribute the product. So the formal definitions of safety and efficacy are important to know, and you have to also know and understand what risk means. So risk is a measure of probability of an adverse event or an untoward outcome occurring, and the severity of the resultant harm to the health of the individual in the population. And safety, therefore, is a judgment of the acceptability of this risk in a specified situation, such as the rollout of a brand new biological product. Efficacy is the probability of benefit to the individuals in a defined population from a medical technology applied for a given medical problem, including the emergence of a pathogen like a virus, like SARS. So for those of you who don't know, we have actually been on what is known as an accelerated timeline in safety and efficacy protocols. A typical timeline is approximately 5 to 10 years from animal testing to safety monitoring. The animal testing can take years, or it can take months. It depends on how the lab data develops. Phase one trials, which include small amounts of people, generally take a few months. And once you're past the phase one trials, if you in fact move past them, you move into phase two trials, which include a higher number of people. And this usually takes up to 2 years to do properly. And if your phase two trial works out okay, and there aren't too many adverse events, you can move to phase three, which involves a much larger cohort of people. And this generally takes several years. After the phase three trials are completed, if they're successful, you move on to the manufacturing process and approval, and these two stages are kind of interlinked. And then the products are monitored for years afterwards using pharmacovigilance tools like VAERS. What we have now is what's called an accelerated timeline. As far as I'm aware, this is a new concept, and they've created it because the WHO announced last year in March that the world was facing a crisis and a global pandemic was declared. The total amount of time that was taken for the Pfizer-BioNTech phase 3 trial was 6 months. Think about that. You might have also noticed that the animal testing was actually not done prior to phase one trials, and the phase two and one trials were mixed, and the phase two trials only took 3 months. So this is passable. Mixing the phases, though, to me is not. They're sequentially ordered for a reason. So the total amount of time that was taken for the Pfizer-BioNTech phase three trial was 6 months. For those of you who don't know, every clinical trial, phase 1, 2, and 3, has an exclusion criteria list, and these lists are usually very long. And they always include pregnant women, lactating women, or women of childbearing age, because we don't want to harm those people. This clinical trial, indeed, included pregnant women, lactating women, as well as immunocompromised individuals, and individuals with autoimmune conditions in the exclusion criteria list, which means they were not allowed to participate in these 6 month trials. That's very, very important to consider because the safety definition was made based on only 6 months of data. So how is it possible that pregnant women are now being injected? There is no safety data pertaining to pregnant women or women of childbearing age or lactating women. It isn't physically possible for it to have been generated in time. So bearing these definitions of safety and efficacy in mind, how it's typically been done versus how it has been done in the context of COVID products, I'm going to present to you now the data from VAERS that includes absolute numbers and some ratios according to the fully vaccinated population. That means two doses, the backlog, and the underreporting factor. So we'll get right into it. This plot is pretty self-explanatory. It's the absolute number of VAERS ID counts, which is the number of people who reported an adverse event, per year for the last 10 years. You can see that the average is approximately 39,000 from 2011 to 2020. And this represents many, many, many different kinds of vaccines. These are all the vaccines combined. When you compare that to 2021, and we're not finished 2021 yet, you can see there's a dramatic difference. I mean, you don't have to do statistics on this kind of graph. It's very different, and it is statistically significantly different. There's actually a 1,108% increase in the number of adverse event reports being filed in VAERS in 2021 to date. And many people wonder if this has something to do with the fact that there are more products being administered. And studies have shown, including my own, that this is not the case. It's not because of an increased number of injections. There's a study done comparing the numbers to flu injections, and so we can very safely say this is not the reason. There's actually an increase in reports associated with these products. And we see the same pattern if we pick out any single type of adverse event. Here I'm showing deaths. The average number of deaths was approximately 150 per year, more or less, for the last 10 years. And this is for all vaccines combined. So, as you can see in the graph on the right, we're at 7,149 deaths for 2021 already, and we still have a few months to go. This is very, very atypical. And the last time a vaccine was rolled out into the human population, the cutoff value of deaths before the product administration was stopped was 50. So it's a very, very, very important question to ask. And I implore all of you who watch this video to ask this question to everybody that you know. What is the cutoff for these products? Because there doesn't seem to be one, and that's not acceptable. This is a comparative plot of the vaccinated people against the reports of adverse events in bears on the right. So the data on the right is mine, the data on the left is from Our World in Data. And this graph represents all the fully vaccinated people, the ones who have received two doses from January to date. And on the right, we see about 500,000 adverse event reports. And what's interesting about this is that there was a steady increase in the adverse events counts each week up until a certain point when I thought that we would see the classic logistic curve, which is an S-shaped curve, start to appear. Because as the number of injections plateaus, we would think that we would also see the number of adverse event reports plateau. But that's not what we see. We actually start to see another increase in adverse event reports. And this is probably due to retroactively added data, but it could also represent reports being added and filed from people who are starting to experience adverse events following sort of a lag phase in side effects. It's because some people are actually reporting side effects occurring months later as part of two-dose protocol. If we normalize that data to the fully vaccinated population, we get this plot. And it's very interesting to note that about 1 in 400 people are reporting an adverse event in the context of these products. And again, I want to stress that these are just the reports that we know about. If we normalize to the fully vaccinated population, the breakthrough cases, which are the COVID cases that occur in spite of the injections, death, emergency room visits, female reproductive issues, hospitalizations, and severe adverse events, which encapsulate the ER, hospital, and deaths, but also disabilities, life-threatening illnesses, or birth defects that occur as a result, or in temporal proximity to the injections. We can also see that 1 in 2,000 individuals are reporting a severe adverse event in the context of the COVID-19 products. What's also alarming are the exploding numbers for the cardiovascular, neurological, and immunological adverse event reports. I predicted this in my last update of the VAERS data that some of you might have seen on YouTube for Vaccine Choice Canada. Back in May, the curves appeared exponential, and I predicted that if they stay this way, which I thought that they would, we would be at about where we are now today. And voila. So this is very concerning, and You'll notice that even though the y-axis is quite the font is quite small, we're almost up to 300,000 events reported in the context of immunological issues. So if we normalize that to the fully vaxxed population, there are approximately 1,500 immunological adverse events occurring per million fully injected people. That's about 1 in 660 individuals who are reporting immunological adverse events in the context of COVID products. And the numbers are just about as high for the cardiovascular and the neurological events being reported as well. In terms of the full data set, or at least the full data set where age data is available, you can see that just about every age group is involved here. Of course, there are fewer adverse event reports for the very young and the very old. This is simply because there are fewer of them that are getting injected proportionally. So we have a total of 473,722 adverse events to date. And we have a total of 86,209 severe adverse event reports. Again, it's not exclusive to a particular age group like the elderly. And this is very important to know because many people associate adverse events with the elderly. These are not the people that are reporting exclusively. It's very evenly distributed. Very normally distributed, rather. In terms of hospitalizations and emergency room visits, we have a similar story. However, in terms of the hospitalizations, there are more people between the ages of 50 and 80 reporting adverse events. As for the emergency room visits, it's pretty evenly distributed across the age groups between 30 and 70. With regards to the cardiovascular, neurological, and immunological adverse events, which are all being reported at rates we've never seen before, we see the same pattern between the ages of 30 and 70. It's pretty evenly distributed, and all the distributions are pretty normal across the age group populations. And what that means is that no one's immune to these adverse events. This is extremely concerning. There have been many, many reports of Bell's palsy and reactivation of multiple sclerosis, for example, in terms of immunological adverse events that are tied to neurological problems. And these are very severe. Anyone who knows someone with MS knows the severity of this condition. And if you've actually lived the last few years of your life in so-called remission and had a rebound, it's not good news. The female reproductive issues, which involve spontaneous abortions to dysmenorrhea, are really on the rise. We're at 7,105 reports to date. And very concerning, considering the rollout only started into children, young children, not long ago, we're already at 20,000 reported adverse events, with the most part happening or being made for the children of age 17. But very concerning, these children make up a large percentage of all of the cardiovascular. This is a serious warning signal being thrown off by VAERS. It cannot be ignored. It's what the system is designed for. This is the pharmacovigilance tool. This is showing its usefulness. Both of these numbers, because when you're considering what the figure on the left represents, I mean, female reproductive issues, first of all, we've never, ever had a product on the market that was causing those kinds of dangers to women, and definitely not in these numbers. So something is very wrong here, and it needs to be investigated. Deaths are also, as I pointed out before, the highest we've seen in 30 years for all the vaccines by far, and most of the reports are being made for the elderly, but this isn't surprising because they're in the higher risk group anyway. Okay, so let's move away from histograms for a moment and get back to our safety categories. So we're pretty much finished with the adverse event counts and ratios. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about the backlog. So the backlog of data is a real thing. I know people on the ground who are telling me that this is a very real thing, and this backlog is apparently quite large. This is the data that exists that hasn't entered the system yet, if ever. So I'm going to focus on the fact that we're losing safety signals because of this backlog. From the beginning of the reporting of the adverse events in the context of the COVID-19 products, we have weekly updates of VAERS data. So every week you can download a file from their site, and it's a brand new data set. And it's a representative of the cumulative data as time goes on. So as I was downloading these files, and luckily I thought to do this from the very beginning, so I have all the data, the trajectory of the data looked something like this. Everything was slowly rising, the adverse event counts, and then somewhere around week 16 approximately, there was a transition to a higher rate of reports. This is what, we would expect, I suppose, as the products were being injected with higher frequency, we would see an increased number of adverse event reports. Seems logical, right? The other data set that you can use as a comparative set is the most recent update. Now, this might sound confusing. Let me try and explain. The most recent update should contain all of the data from the previous updates from the beginning. So if you plot these two trajectories of data, let's say per week, you calculate, say, the number of deaths per week according to each of the weekly updates and the most recent update, you just pull that data out, then these two trajectories should follow each other really nicely. But they don't. The most recent updated file looks a lot more like this. And you'll notice two things about this that are really irksome. One, this white gap in between them, which represents data, question mark. And also, the most alarming part is that if you take into account, let's just look at week 10, okay? This is the actual data here, the two data sets. So if we look at week 10, it appeared as though we had 7,065 severe adverse event reports for that date, and so on and so on and so on. But looking at the most recent update, what we actually had is something closer to 27,000. This is a very large difference, especially when you're considering what a severe adverse event is. So what this means is that a person who might have been watching the VAERS data and wondering to themselves, should I get this injection or not, would have seen this and thought, okay, well, there isn't much of a risk according to this number. But the number wasn't correct because the data hadn't been entered. This is another example here. It's a little bit more dramatic. It's also the severe adverse events, but if you look even earlier on, at week 4, it's a very, very dramatic delta right there. So the safety signal that was meant to be thrown off, or seen, pardon me, that was thrown off, that was meant to be seen, was not being seen at the time of the signal. So let's move on to another disturbing piece of information. This is the potential underreporting factor that me and some colleagues have co-calculated. We've all done it independently, and we came up with the same number, so that's always a good thing. As part of the Pfizer phase 3 clinical trial, This is actually a table lifted directly from one of their reports. They calculated the percentage of severe adverse event reports or severe adverse event occurrences in two groups. One was a group that had the mRNA product, and one was the placebo group, and they were about the same sizes, albeit them both small. So the percentage of people who experienced a severe adverse event was about 0.7%. If you take that into account as your metric for determining the underreporting factor, it goes something like this. The number of Pfizer doses administered as of August 10th, this is when I did the calculation, so it's not exceptionally up to date, but it's pretty up to date, was 351,400,000. So if you multiply the percent occurrence rate of SAEs by this number, then you're going to get the expected number of severe adverse event reports for the number of people who've had the injections. So we have this 2.5 million number. That's how many people we would expect. So how many people do we actually observe having severe adverse events? Well, it was something about 80,000 on August 10th. So what you do is you divide the expected number by the observed number to see what the underreporting factor actually would be, because you have to determine, okay, if we're supposed to have this many and this is how many we have, what's that multiplication factor in between? So it's 31. Easy peasy, right? The beauty of this is that we use their own calculation and data, which for anybody who's been following this might be scratching their head about at this point, but this is the number that we've come up with. And since the underreporting itself of mild adverse events is probably higher than for the severe adverse events, then this multiplication factor is probably okay. It's not inappropriate for use for any adverse event. It's probably a little different, but for safety's sake, we can use it for just about any adverse event, and we most likely wouldn't be far off. So to put this into context, we can go back to the number of cardiovascular, neurological, and immunological adverse events reported to date and multiply these numbers by 31, and this is what we get. If this doesn't, represent a safety signal being thrown off, then I don't know what does. I also calculated estimates for the breakthrough cases, for the female reproductive issues, and for the children. And thanks to the work of Steve Kirsch, who's doing really, really good work on this subject and fighting really hard to get data out to the public, he did these calculations. They're not up to date, but you'll get an idea. There are 10,000 odd types of adverse events reported in the context of COVID-19 products. Think about that for a second. 10,000 different types of adverse event reports. This is also, it's never been seen before in history. It's very, very concerning once again. So to summarize this first part, and this is the longest, so don't get frustrated. The adverse event counts themselves are atypically high, and they're continuing to grow. And again, I'm not making any predictions as to whether or not this is going to become a logistic curve soon. But for the time being, it really appears as though the adverse event numbers are starting to grow again. It's not just happening in the elderly. I know that a lot of people have associations with anything COVID-related with elderly people. It's not just happening in the elderly. It's not just happening in the autoimmune conditioned people. It's not just happening in immunocompromised people. It's happening across the board. And alarmingly enough, it's happening in children at very high rates. And these are heart problems, which last time I checked, that wasn't a thing. But we can talk about that, and we will. And very importantly, the backlog of data is resulting in lost safety signals. This is probably the most illuminating thing that someone can get from this data here. The underreporting factor is, it's a real thing. We need more data on that. So this is an estimate for now. But the backlog of data, it's a very real thing. And the lost safety signals, it's also a very real thing. Many points of concern there. So let's move on to causation. Did you hear my little giggle there? This is a very hot topic. There's a almost a ferocious group of people who absolutely refuse to even consider the possibility that something that you inject into your body could possibly cause any kind of subsequent effect. Not only is it unscientific to do so, it's not plausible considering all of the evidence that's mounting, especially in this specific case. So the way that an epidemiologist or a biologist might provide evidence for causation using biological data is to use something called the Bradford Hill criteria. The Bradford Hill criteria comprises a set of 10 points that should be satisfied in order to provide evidence of causation that's pretty irrefutable. This is how you do this epidemiologically. You don't have to satisfy all 10. If you did, that would be better. But if you satisfied up to 8, I think that would be very strong supportive evidence. It's also vital to point out here that the onus is on the opposition of the causation argument to provide strong counterexamples or counter evidence to the claim of causation, either using the Bradford Hill criteria itself or a strong body of evidence. And the very most important one of these, and I have done this, the very most important one is temporality. You have to have something preceding the other thing in order to make a claim of causation. And the closer those two things occur, the stronger the possibility that there actually is a causative effect. As part of the VAERS data, we have many dates recorded. One of them is the vaccination date. One of them is the onset of the adverse event date. And so if you calculate the difference between these two and plot them on a two-dimensional time series plot against the report, the percentage of reported adverse events, if there was no causal relationship, you would expect a straight line. Because the chance that the adverse event itself would occur at any given point would be equal. Am I right? So we would expect the percentage of the reported adverse events to be the same for any given time period before or after the injection if there is no causative effect. So the trajectory along the x-axis would have an even distribution about the y-axis. But that's not what we see. We see something like this. This is the actual plot of the deaths, percentage of reported deaths, against the difference, the deltas, between the vaccination date and the death date. And you see a clustering of data around day zero, or zero, which represents up to 24 hours. And this is suspicious. Let's use that word. As a positive control, I checked this for anaphylaxis as well. Now, anaphylaxis is an acute reaction to a trigger. So we would expect almost all of the anaphylaxis reports to come immediately, within 24 hours, definitely less than 24 hours after the injection. If the injection was inducing the anaphylactic shock, that's accepted. So about 80%, a little more, of the anaphylaxis reports are being reported immediately. So it's a way to strengthen the claim that what we're seeing here is a causative effect. For those of you who aren't aware, myocarditis has become a very strong signal, especially in young people between the ages of 12 and 19, and even more especially in young boys. This is a plot that represents the dose 1 and dose 2 numbers of adverse event reports for myocarditis across age. And this is also evidence to support the causative effect, because if there was no relationship between the dose or the injection and the development of myocarditis, then we wouldn't see this very large differential between the magnitude of the number of reports. This needs to be explained if this is not causation. And this number, 1,176, actually represents the number of myocarditis reports to date. This was August 27th. And interestingly, this plot here, this is the same kind of plot that I was showing previously. This is all dose, all age frequency reporting. About a quarter of the reports were made within 24 hours, and almost half of them were made within 48 hours. Alarmingly, 12.5% of all myocarditis reports are made in children between the ages of 12 and 15. And these percentages of the reports being made in very close temporal proximity to the injections go way up in this age group to 41% within 24 hours and almost 70% within 48. So this probably has something to do with parents being concerned for their children, but these are very high rates, reporting rates, which are temporally associated with the injections. The last piece of evidence to support causation is this. This is simply a time series plot of all the death data to date from VAERS against the people who have been fully vaccinated, that is, have received two doses of one of the Pfizer, Moderna, or Janssen products. And they pretty much follow a one-to-one path. Again, maybe this is causation, maybe it isn't. It's a number of coincidences that are stacking up if this isn't a causative effect being seen. So to summarize causation, there's a large percentage of reports, that not just for death. I did this for many, many groups and many standalone adverse events as well, being made within 48 hours. The Bradford Hill criteria is satisfied. The dosing myocarditis reports are very strong evidence of a causative effect. And very recently, a report came out that actually shows a clinical difference between hearts, indicating that autoimmune myocarditis is being induced by the injections. And it's different from myocarditis that is induced from COVID. This is shown clinically. And there's also basically a one-to-one ratio between the pathways of death and the fully injected population. So now let's move on to... We're going to talk a little bit about the Delta variant in particular. So before we talk about the Delta variant, let's talk about what a variant is. So basically, it represents the entire genome of an entity, let's call it, say, of a virus, that has at least one or more mutations. So it's slightly different from the parental, let's call it, version of the genome. This, of course, happens naturally as the replication process goes on and adaptations occur in the context of the host. And it can also be affected by environmental changes, such as the introduction of vaccines or exogenous drugs. There are four big variants of the SARS virus currently. We have the Alpha, Beta, Gamma, and this Delta variant, which, as far as we know, started out in India, moved to the UK, and then to Israel. And that's what we're going to focus on now. When did this variant arise in Israel? This is an important question to ask, because its arrival and also the spread of the variant in Israel are interconnected. And we don't know how they're interconnected right now, so it's very important to investigate this. It's possible that the COVID-19 products are driving the production and spread dissemination of this Delta variant. So this is a phylogenetic tree. It's a way to show how a particular genome of an entity, let's call it, changes genetically as time passes. So it's the evolutionary map, let's say. So you can use this kind of map to determine how different, say, two variants are, when they arose, how many of them there are. It's very informative. It's a lot of information in a simple diagram. So the Delta variant arose in Israel. It was first sequenced on May 9th. And of course, you know, these aren't exact dates. This is just when it was first sequenced in a lab. And we discovered that it contained one or more mutations that made it genetically different from the other variants. Shortly thereafter, around July, we started to see some clustering of these Delta variants in Israel. It's very interesting to compare and contrast the timing that this happened with other data. So I'm making no claims here, but I thought it was interesting to present this. The daily COVID-19 vaccine doses administered is shown on the right here, and this is Our World in Data. They're fantastic. If anyone needs a source of data, I would go to these people. And around May 9th, when the first Delta variant was sequenced, we were about here in the dosing. It had gone way down. And then slowly, slowly, as you can see, the dosing started to go up. This represents the third shots that are being administered in Israel, and millions of people have received them to date. Interestingly, the clustering that I mentioned of the Delta cases in Israel were somewhere near mid-July. We started to see a whole bunch of these variants. And that's right about the same time when the number of doses was starting to climb. Another very interesting thing is that 98.18% of all the sequences now are the Delta variant in Israel. I found this very, very interesting. And this just to compare and contrast how the booster doses may or may not be related to this. They started being administered in late July, and they're still being administered. So here's another interesting plot. This is the daily new confirmed COVID cases in Israel compared with the vaccine doses administered and the phylogenetic tree, which shows the clustering of the Delta variants in Israel. So I've marked July 17th on both the new cases plot and the doses, and they're all kind of lined up. At that time, that's when the cases started to rise, and that's when the doses started to go up. So one might think, okay, well, they started to see the case count go up, so they got worried. You know, the people who are doubly injected aren't protected anymore from this new variant, so we better triple up and give them a new dose. There could also be some detrimental emergent phenomenon that people aren't thinking closely enough on right now, and I will get to that. So this is a plot generated by Rafael Zioni, who's a medical doctor in one of our hospitals here in Israel, and he put this data together. And it clearly shows that there are, per age group, by decade, there are more cases of COVID in the vaccinated group by far. So percentage-wise, the cases in the vaccinated group are far higher percentage. I mean, they comprise most of the cases in every age group. It's quite a remarkable and stunning finding. This is directly from the Ministry of Health dashboard where the data is collected from. One might suggest that what we're seeing here is vaccine failure. It's interesting to note that the end date of this data that was collected in this chart matches the July 17th date when the number of third doses started to be administered. I guess that was the logic. They saw the case count go up and they decided, well, these people aren't protected anymore against this Delta variant, which comprises this huge percentage of all the variants. And so we better triple up and get these people re-immunized. I pretty much can hear what everybody's thinking who's listening to this right now. I'm going to leave you to your thoughts, because I'd rather be thought-provoking than to make any claims at this point. Just to summarize now this Delta variant section, clearly we have the generation of escape mutants on our hands, and this is at the host population level. So this is beneficial, of course, for the virus. This is how they evolve and survive, and they can go on to reinfect new hosts and propagate their species ad infinitum. And as they do this, of course, they're mutating all the while. From the point of view of a risk-benefit analysis, because that's what this is all about, the injections are not doing what they're designed to do, which is provide protective immunity in a broad, potent, and long-lasting way. They might be, in some cases, providing relief of symptoms. Some data does show this. But when weighing the risks and the benefits here and considering the adverse event situation, it's really important to recognize that immunity, even if temporarily effective, appears to be waning now. So this last section we've basically already talked about, but I'm going to elaborate on this now. This section will be on a concept that is very, very interesting, which has been proposed by some of the world experts, and that's the concept of us causing the mutations to occur, possibly in a direction that could be very detrimental. And when that happens, it's referred to as a variant of concern. If there is clear evidence that the variant is causing problems that weren't seen before in a previous version, then this is a variant of concern, as termed by virologists. This can happen naturally, of course, through natural evolutionary processes, or it can happen via epigenetic pressure. And this is where the problems lie. Some leading world experts, such as Geert van den Bosch, have suggested a long time ago that this is going to be a problem that we are going to have to face. And we might already be facing it and have lucked out so far in terms of virulent strains. So we haven't met a variant of concern yet, but this is not to say that we won't. The Delta variant, for example, was found to be very, very infectious, but not that virulent, which is good news for us. The question is, are we helping to drive viral mutations to occur toward a variant of concern? So I want to back up a bit and talk a little bit about breakthrough infections. I was on a Zoom call the other day with Matthew Guthrie, and he asked a very meaningful question. He asked what the background or the etymology of breakthrough was, because to him, it seemed to imply some kind of primary response meaning. So this prompted me to find out. My mother's a linguist, so etymology is a very big thing in our family and to me. And it has a military meaning, to overcome or penetrate a barrier. So in this context, the barrier would be the injections, which are supposed to provide protective immunity, except they don't, and the virus is overcoming it. So it's called a breakthrough infection. And seeing as how we're on definitions, let's talk about epigenetic pressure. So these are modifications of the genome by exogenous factors. So vaccines and mRNA biological injectables are examples of this, and they can actually put evolutionary pressure on viruses such that they speed up the mutation process and, like I said, potentially create more virulent and more dangerous variants. So immune escape can actually take place both at the host population level and at the intrahost level. So what you're looking at here is a phylogenetic tree of the emergence of two of the most prevalent variants, Delta and Alpha, I believe, is the blue. Delta is the green. And the red line represents when the injection rollout started for the U.S. and Israel. They both started around mid-December in 2020. And it's hard not to look at this and see the obviousness of the timing. The emergence of both of these new variants came very, very closely, temporally, following the rollout of these products. So it's possible that the rollout of these products actually drove the emergence of these variants. So again, I want to stress this point. We know that this is happening, but the danger lies in the emergence of a more virulent strain, not a more infectious strain, because the Delta variant is very infectious, as I mentioned, but it's not so virulent. So this is how we're pushing our luck with this. And if we keep putting these so-called booster shots into people, we're just going to keep teaching this virus how to escape and evolve to our detriment. So having defined a breakthrough infection now, let's explain what it is, why it's happening. We would presume if the injections were functioning that someone would have protective immunity in the form of both neutralizing and non-neutralizing antibodies and T-cell responses. And some studies have shown that this is the case. So if that had been the case, then in the context of a breakthrough infection, then that would be lacking. This is what we appear to be seeing in Israel with this Delta variant, because the large proportion of people who are ending up both positive and in the hospital were doubly injected and experiencing a breakthrough infection. There's another issue here that I wonder about, and that's the obfuscation of the natural, innate, and adaptive responses in the context of a targeted immune-inducing therapy. When you inject the coating material for the spike protein, you have the protein produced for the spike, and these have antigenic proteins on its surface, and the immune system responds by mounting a response against these specific proteins on the spike. So you get antibodies, you get T cells, and all sorts of molecules. So the problem with that is that it appears to be a problem. It's very, very targeted. It's very specific. They're actually called this protein-specific cells or antibodies. And so when met with the wild-type version or a variant version of the virus, which of course is much more than just spike proteins, it's a mutated version of the spike and all these other proteins associated with the full virion, the responses are suboptimal. So no protective immunity is gained. It begs the question, what might have been the outcome if instead of the injections, the person was able to mount a natural disease course, innate immune response, and or an adaptive response? Because these responses are broad, potent. This has also been found in many studies. It's peer-reviewed. This is established. Very potent, long-lasting responses in the form of T cells and B cells in so-called natural immunity. So it begs the question, are the injected individuals actually immunocompromised in a way? I'll leave the audience to think about that. As I return to some data again, we are currently at 14,448 breakthrough COVID cases that have been reported to VAERS as of August 27th, 2021. So again, to bring up the underreporting factor, the actual number is probably a lot larger than this. And again, the distribution according to age is pretty normal. Older people aged 60 to 70 appear to be reporting the most, which probably means that they're experiencing more breakthrough COVID cases. In order to define or identify a variant, you need to sequence it. from specimens that are collected from patients that have COVID-19. This is necessary, so I assume that's how they're defining it, but I don't know that yet. I would need to confirm that. But of course, that's how it's done, so that should be the case. There's a lot of semantics involved in this whole COVID pandemic thing. The definition of a case still isn't defined for me, because the PCR testing, so-called, is so up in the air with the false positives and the high CT levels, and nobody knows if a standard being used within and also between hospitals and labs. I mean, there are so many unknowns. So, I mean, it's a very hard thing right now to be a data analyst, because there are so many unanswered questions. But as far as breakthrough infections go, I mean, I would assume that this means that somebody previously had not had COVID. I think they're supposed to test before they inject people. And then they got the injection, so they mounted a primary response, as they're meant to, against the spike protein antigens. They generated antibodies and had some T-cell responses as well. And then in spite of that, they were exposed or challenged with, say, the Delta variant, and subsequently became COVID positive, presumably with symptoms. Or it could be that they're testing positive because of some residual DNA artifacts. So to summarize this section, the breakthrough infection rates are increasing. We know that for sure. If we trust the testing procedure, because a breakthrough infection would have to be confirmed with a PCR test. And this actually could be the result of waning immunity from the injections. It's also possible, based on what I'm seeing in the adverse event data in VAERS, that the injections are propagating immunocompromisation. They're actually rendering the people less able to mount a potent immune response. And the epigenetic, this is the most concerning thing for me. It's possible that we're driving the emergence of more deadly variants with these injections. It just seems like a really bad idea to teach these viruses how to escape at our own hand, because that's exactly what we're doing right now. We're teaching them. Just like antibiotic resistance, it's the same thing. It's analogous. So we've reached the end of what I wanted to cover today in this presentation, and I applaud everybody who's made it so far. I'm not going to reiterate much. We discussed safety and efficacy in the COVID-19 injectable products, both of which appear to be lacking substantially, which puts into question whether or not we should actually continue administering these products. Definitely, in my opinion, we should not until further studies have been done, especially in the context of low-risk groups, such as young people and groups of people who probably shouldn't have these products put into their bodies, such as pregnant and lactating women, based on the fact that they were in the exclusion criteria list. So to conclude, I haven't even mentioned treatment at any point during this presentation, but this appears to be the best course of action. And Peter McCulloch has developed and outlined a very, very strong early treatment protocol that you can access freely. It would probably be a good idea to stop the injection rollout until we have further data, like I said, especially in young people, because it does seem to be having a very bad effect on our young people, especially in the context of cardiovascular issues such as myocarditis. Something that nobody's talking about yet that I've heard of, at least not enough, is the development of treatment options for the injection injured. This is going to become a huge issue in the coming months and years. I can say this very safely, seeing as how I've been following the trajectories of the rise of all of the adverse events in total and the individual ones, seeing as how the largest group of adverse events are the immunological adverse events, followed closely by neurological and cardiovascular. So this is going to be a very, very important thing to address. And I circle that back to point one it's probably going to involve the same kinds of drugs that are effective against COVID itself. That would be my guess. So the final recommendation is to use early treatment with known efficacious and safe drugs. I won't say much more. I just want to acknowledge all the wonderful people that I've met thanks to this pandemic. Brilliant minds, passionate people, people who still do science, who still ask questions, even if it's uncomfortable to do so, or even if you get attacked for doing so. I really applaud each and every one of you. Thank you for listening. At least somebody is. I want to finish by making sure that everybody knows that I am funded by you via a fellowship that's been created to honor one Joshua Kuntz, who is the son of Ted Kuntz, who is the president of Vaccine Choice Canada. He was a vaccine-injured boy, and he is no longer with us. So we have the honor of honoring him, his life, and his passing in the form of this fellowship. So any donation to this fellowship fund goes directly to me to help me do this work. So if you like what I'm doing and you want to support me, I would love any help at all. $2, it doesn't matter, large or small, it all helps. So again, thank you for listening and stay tuned for the next update.